Yeah, on our worldwide website, I have all the lyrics.
Okay, okay.
You look under membership services, interesting books and articles, and if it's anything songbook, is listed under books with all the lyrics.
Okay, you are going to publish the book?
Yes, well, it's available for a $10 contribution. I don't have any with me today, though. That would be commercializing.
You selling over there?
No, I did not. I deliberately did not bring the songbooks because that would be a conflict of interest. But they're available to those who want to send for them. Good idea.
Right. That you'll just spend it all on worthwhile causes. Yeah.
I think we're going to have a session that's just open to everybody to talk and get viewpoints here. And, got a small enough group that everybody can have their say. I'm going to be the moderator, supposedly.
I mean, if everyone wants to use the overhead, they can.
Yeah, the overhead's available.
Why are you going?
Yeah, anybody can contribute here. I just want to say to start with that I was the wide variety of talks I think was very interesting. The from the philosophy of that was discussed and the planets and just a wide variety that made the whole conference.
I tried to make it interesting and appeal to everyone. I mean, SETI is an unusual subject in the sense that it has such a wide appeal and involves so many disciplines. You know, almost every ology you can think of is involved in SETI. That's why it's a good base for the educational aspects of science. It really gets the young people hooked at it early on. Hopefully they will stay, stay in the sciences, much to the benefit of the economy later on.
Well, I think the talk that was given on the survey taken in Spain illustrated that most people don't think it's going to make any difference in their lives whether...
Well, I'm just wondering if the average Joe Public, how this was done, you stop people in the street or you fill out a questionnaire? In the home, as you visit them in the home. They don't really have time to think about the question, do they?
Well, we could be optimistic.
I mean, I'm asking you, do they... I mean, you basically ask them a question and then they respond, right? Yeah, so I reckon that a lot of people don't really have the time to contemplate what the average person, what would be the impact on them and their people they know over a period of time.
What I'm getting to is that it's an education issue.
Well, it's a bit, but it's also, I think people need to think about it fully.
Well, how do you get them to think about it? I mean,
you can't get the instant response in a survey like that, I think, may be a bit meaningless, in terms of
but that's
when they when
they
say,
right.
Well,
yeah.
I found a trouble with this survey because people never think about this.
Right.
So they confront the survey and they say,
Like the flat tax.
Which was the size?
Get a quick reaction.
How many people? Sorry.
249.
And which is the population of?
Oh, but.
So which percentage?
Oh, yeah.
And with what criteria did you select the distribution? I'm sorry, I was not in your talk, so.
Okay. I didn't talk about it. It was in Spain, the center of sociological investigations. We talk with them and tell us how pick a randomly a sample, and we follow their rules. And they told us that with 200 people is enough to make a good.
But it was overwhelmingly, I think it was 80% or something number like that thought it would make no difference.
No. Yeah.
Probably you are not aware that here in the US you have annually polls made by Gallup,
yeah,
and they have the same numbers. So I don't know why you are so strange.
Well, no, I just think because what you just said, that it's, the question comes as a surprise to them. And it's an instantaneous response, and I think people generally, if they haven't thought about it, need to actually consider it longer, maybe for a day or two, the implications of the question, and you get maybe a more accurate response. It may drop that percentage a bit.
Well, I mean, it's not that I'm against more thoughtful responses. I mean, I think certainly that's, you know, that would aid in its own way in such survey research. But I just wonder, even if they gave it a little more thought, if they really thought about it, it seems to me they might come up with exactly the same answer. I mean, the world, it seems to me, that most people live in most of the time is a world that is governed by things that, from the point of view of science, are very old and antiquated. Yeah, and you know, for people who are, you know, religious or church going, or you know, they're living a life which is thousands of years old, in effect, in some very decisive respects. And so, for such people, indeed, a thoughtful response, maybe, well, am I not going to get married because this changes? Am I not going to have children because of this change? Am I not going to love my wife any more, any less because of this change? And, you know, if you think about that, the answer would be, no, that's not going to change. The important things in my life are not going to change. So there's something reasonable behind that.
Well, but
bear in mind that something like 75% of people surveyed believe that extraterrestrial intelligent life did exist. Therefore, the proof of that would merely confirm what they already knew intuitively, and it's not going to change anything at all for them. I mean, except that they could maybe say to their skeptical neighbors, see, I told you so.
Well, there's also the issue, I mean, extension of that, whether or not, detecting an ETI signal, that's one thing, knowing we're not alone, but supposing we actually got real data out of that somehow there will be cultural contamination, it would affect our society in technology, maybe some future technology would then eventually repeat to that, come down and affect their employment opportunities or everything
else.
It
may affect them, but the issue is that they don't think so.
Sure, it's going to, they're undoubtedly it will have great effect in some way, maybe not on the
whole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I am a little bit skeptical about that traditional point of view that we are expecting some sort of ET signal with a lot of technological recipes or sociological recipes. I'm a little bit. I disagree with Carl Sagan's opinion of how, or what kind of messages we should get. Considering that the transmitting civilization is an intelligent civilization, because if the transmitting civilization doesn't know how the receiver is, they cannot give you cannot, let me put a simple example. You cannot give an atomic bomb to a child,
right,
because it would be dangerous for that child.
Right.
So in the same sense,
you cannot give car keys to a teenager.
Exactly.
Right.
I think it's beyond that, actually. That's a kind of a moral type thing, but just think of it in terms of whatever intelligence is out there, more than likely is far in advance compared to us. Okay, they put up the equivalent of the Encyclopedia Galactica out there. Wouldn't that be the equivalent of like going to a Paleolithic society and saying, here are the laws of quantum chromodynamics. It'll be meaningless. Use them.
All these rules are yours, except for
there's just so much between where we are as far as our understanding and conceptualization of the universe and how they have conceptualized the universe. Whatever information they give to us may be absolutely meaningless to us.
Like but you're suggesting that it's impossible for them to come down nearer to our level to have an
opinion. But then again, I discussed this earlier with Paul. For example, look at the intelligent species on our own planet. Like for instance, the dolphins, whales, maybe primates. they communicate, that we don't understand a single word they're saying, and I'm sure that in their own mind they're saying, okay, let's try to make this as simple as possible. Okay.
So stupid humans.
Well, I'm going to take Guillermo's skepticism a step farther. Not only are we not going to get this great wealth of information, I'm not even sure information content can be transmitted, unless Stuart happens to be right with his hunch about broadband optical. Well, let's look at the microwave problem. If my numbers are representative of Earth's technology that I showed yesterday, if Arecibo, in order to communicate over 30,000 light years, needs to integrate for 8,000 seconds, well, folks, we're talking about nanobaud there. And I don't believe there will be information content. If we're lucky, we'll detect a carrier, and that's about it.
Well, all you're saying is a very good reason why, again, why they're not going to send the signals at RF. You keep talking about that. Well, you're just giving reasons why they're not going to send signals at RF.
When you say send, you mean direct beamed signals.
Right.
Okay. Which is why, contrary to Jill's experience in the Southern Hemisphere, what we're going to be finding, if anything, is leakage. And we need to raise our technology level to detect leakage.
Okay.
I disagree with the leakage idea. I think unless one directs a high intensity, very high signal level, extremely monochromatic, low noise. From the analyses that I've run, at least, it's very amply clear to me that just sending out signals in an isotropic manner will quickly cut that level to a point where it's meaningless, definitely in the short wavelength region. And I'm completely familiar with the KT problem and that in microwave you have an advantage and so on and so forth, but I just don't think that the leakage concept, you know, whether we had BMUs pointing out there somewhere or whatever, I don't believe that that's the way it'll work. I think the way, if it works at all, is the highly directed energy source.
Well, a lot of our energy sources that are leakage from our plant are highly directed. They're not just, they just happen not to be directed deliberately at ETIs.
At something like one astronomical unit out many hundreds, perhaps thousands of light years? Or is there such...
Run the numbers on our over-the-horizon search radars. They're detectable now to about 10 light years. That's not much, but we're still in our early development of our technology.
From what base are they being operated? From a terrestrial base, right?
Yes.
Are they, well, then they got to be scanning the sky at a fantastic rate.
This is a very good point. The scanning problem is indicative of why we must really do real-time, all-direction, all-sky coverage, which is something we've never attempted before. Let's consider the Wild Signal of Ohio State. We know a big ear can encompass one part in 10 to the sixth of the sky, roughly. Now, we don't have a million big ears, and at $50 million a piece, we're never going to. So that means that we can only see a tiny portion of the sky, and we're on a rotating planet with a drift scan telescope. Why is that signal not repeated after 100 follow-on studies? Because it came from a transmitter on a rotating planet, perhaps, that also only encompasses one part in 10 to the 6th of the sky, which means our likelihood of aiming at each other is 1 in 10 to the 12th. How long do you have to keep looking under those circumstances before you get another hit?
My guess would be that if there will be transmitters, I think they would be space-based. They're likely to be directed at a receiving agency for a calculated period of time rather than to bank on what the Earth will do or not do. This whole idea of getting out of space,
yes,
get around the wavelength problem, the absorption problems, and a number of other problems.
Yeah, I want to make, like Wormel wanted to say something here, but I just want to make a comment. This is an optical SETI conference, and I think we should stop talking about RF and talk about optical SETI.
Well, to me, RF and optical are all the same. Just the only thing that's different is the wavelength.
Okay.
All the same.
The technologies are significantly different.
Only on this planet.
No, I have some comments or some things that were said in this paper. One, there is a paper that will appear in the proceedings that discuss very thoroughly the topic about the images, how to construct images. And there's a big discussion about the early proposal made, for example, by Drake and Oliver, how to construct that images, because with that images you don't get an ambiguous interpretation.
Right.
Yes. So we have to, the first beliefs that were some sort of universal kind of transmissions probably are wrong. In the CAPLI meeting, there were a special session trying to discuss the universality of cognitive systems. But it is related with what he said, that is a topic that needs further discussion, because probably we are wrong in the kind of signals that we are searching. Another thing is why it is important to have a leakage detection, because supposing that there is somebody transmitting beaming exactly to the Earth, we have no way to synchronize in a priori way to synchronize the reception time with the transmission. Taking into account, for example, that Project Phoenix only looks 200 seconds for each star, well, the probability of getting something interesting is the age of the Earth. No, the inverse of the age of the Earth plus per that 200 seconds. So it's extremely low.
Right, I agree.
Okay.
What do you do about
so
that?
So doing leakage reduction, that you have a better chance to do that.
Okay. Well, I'm disagreeing with the last part. Everything else is okay, but I think the irradiance that you get when you look at, you know, where things can reasonably come from, unless that agency is transmitting, you know, 10 to the 20th watts and not omnidirectional, I doubt seriously that we would have sufficient signal strength.
Well, there's only one given. That is, if we do not look for liquid radiation, we cannot detect it with any technology.
Well, you know, that's right. Trying to prove a negative, as you know, is not logically possible.
The last thing that I would like to do is that probably other better strategy is to look for a spin-off of technological activities.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of garbage that could appear in the space environment generated by extraterrestrial technological activities. If you look at the 70s, 60s and 70s different proposals of how to detect technological activity, you will find several proposals of detecting, for example, nuclear waste in the central star, so that will give you some strange spectral lines. And actually in the 80s, using one of the 2 meters telescope from Kitt Peak, somebody searched for that nuclear waste traces around nearby stars. So
infrared signatures from Dyson spheres are another example.
Oh, well, that's the second example.
Was that in the hope that if we found an ETI doing that, then it was okay for us to start doing that?
Yeah. After all, more advanced.
also in the optical range, Drake and Sklovsky in the early 60s also proposed that probably some civilization will drop into the central star several strange material like missions. Something like that, and you will detect that line very easily, and that will be an indicator of.
But I still think it's so easy with technology, at least in the next 100 years or so, to actually broadcast that tight beam and put wideband information on and put video on there, real time delayed video, which is going to cross the cultural barrier between dissimilar civilizations. Why not use that? I mean, it's so simple to do that.
There is no question that we have the capacity to develop that technology. The real question is, what is the cultural imperative for other civilizations to exercise that?
Well, hold on, if they develop radio technology, I can't think there'd be more than 100 years between that and laser technology.
But I think he's asking another question. The question is why would they transmit it deliberately to a society? Forget about it.
Yeah, no, just
laser.
The why? Question about leakage. But
why deliberately? Should I say?
Well, it's a bit small answer for that. This is on the line of thinking like the galaxy would tend to become an internet, and the idea really is this: they would want to transmit to us because not for our own sake, but because we would act as a relay point, and then if others do that, then there would spread essentially a net of intercommunication, and one might have a kind of philosophical attitude about this. And I think there's even a philosophical expression, I forget the moment, something or the other, where you think that the reason for things is because there's a purpose behind it. And the purpose behind it would be that the universe is more or less scheduled for the purpose of communicating with itself, given enough eons of time. And so we're merely a catalyst in that, and we're going to be, if you will, scheduled to receive information from inward, from the galaxy, in order to pass it around. Now,
I go along with that.
I didn't get a chance when I had my little spiel up here. You know, after reading enough of this stuff, you form some opinions that are, you know, maybe wrong, maybe right, but on this problem of where are they, and I get the impression maybe there's an annular area around the nuclear bulge where there's a greater probability of life, intelligent life similar to ours. And it's around this annulus, perhaps, you know, where the metallicity of stars is not too great as it is in the center and not too small as it is outside. And so perhaps our ultimate object then would be to foster this communicative net. And that would be the reason, if you will, why there would be motivation. You know, it wouldn't be an altruistic notion. It wouldn't be anything to beam at us, so to speak, to help us necessarily. It would be a efficiency kind of a thing. In order to spread the word, so to speak, efficiently, we're going to be one of the cogs in the big wheel. You know, it's another version of Descartes' concept of the. Is that long-winded enough?
Would every civilization feel almost obliged to participate and
I think it's a very interesting talk, but let me take the devil's advocate, so to speak, position on that. Like, given the politics that exist in every civilized country, including ours, what arguments, how can you ever convince the Congress or whatever to put up the money for such a transmission? Under what guise, role, economic benefit?
Well, my response is really this. I don't think that I can give you a singular reason, you know, for what you're asking, but I think the trend of what you want is really there with the gentleman there that made the survey and the kind of surveys that I hear about, which are like this. The younger kids are highly tuned into the idea of ETs and ETI and SETI and so on. You ask a little kid, you know, who's seen a few of the movies, why ETIs, of course, Robin, they exist. Yeah. Now, that's very important because whereas our compatriots, older people, they're sort of reluctant with the pocketbook lately, as you know, and they don't see any sense in doing this stuff at all when their kids are hungry. But I think in the future, in the 21st century, when the younger kids grow up and the question then becomes, do we want to spend money on science and this kind of science, there'll be, I think, a trend toward it. At least that's the long-winded answer to that. I don't have a specific answer, but what I'm saying is the larger trend, the consciousness, especially in the younger crowd, in the future will be there, I believe, to affect the trend so that you won't have to have this sledgehammer, okay, that will knock monies off. People will be willing to do it.
Good answer. But I'm not sure that it's going to take a long time, is what
can come instead, because if we start, like with the Discovery extra solar planets now, we're going to start having one.
Well, they all feed into each other. That's right.
We may well find that there will be public pressure to do something about this within a few years, despite what Congress initially wished.
I don't want to monopolize the discussion here, but I do have this one thing. When Stuart and I first began to talk about, you know, this meeting in so on. I was telling him of some reservations I have about SETI and this thing. And I told him, hey, off the cuff, but, you know, not even a single planet. I mean, I was aware of the pulsar 1226, what it is. You know, not even a single real planet has been ever found. You know, how are we going to convince
that
people?
That was 6 months ago.
As I was writing the draft of my report, I had to take it back because. Correlation, I think everybody who has had any life experience knows, between intelligence and benevolence. And if we were to, in fact, establish some real communication, I mean, you know, obviously the time delay problem and all this, you know, maybe there isn't going to be, you know, a phone call in the response, you know, but for several hundred, maybe a thousand years. But if they are not benevolent, and we communicate, are we not jeopardizing our very existence?
Well, this is the background of why I said, how do you justify transmission? Because anybody who makes an argument why to transmit, somebody in Congress will make that very point. And the fear factor, people do things more out of fear than anything else, at least the human psyche does. And that fear factor will be a pressure against ever transmitting out.
Okay. I'm not quite true about your hypothesis about correlations. Let's put it in other words. If you don't have, if moral and the evolution of technology doesn't go together, you got a very unstable situation. The better example is our society. We have to change our moral principles or improve our moral principles in order to survive with the evolution of technology. Because if you don't do that, certainly you will self-destroy your civilization. For example, you cannot imagine a civilization with interstellar travel capacity that doesn't some sort of pass those adolescent problems of self-destroying, because if you have the technology to go from one star to another star, you also have the technology to destroy the whole civilization, and you have to solve your moral problems inside your civilization before going to another star.
Unfortunately, I don't think that follows.
That is one of the it was stated in one of Arthur Clarke's books that it is unstable combination to have high technology and I don't know how to define bad morals.
That may be true, but it's perfectly possible to imagine high technology and bad morals in the sense of, say, a tremendous tyranny that precisely out of the fear of the instability of life with high technology would impose a high level of coercion on most people most of the time in order to keep them in line.
But if you get any perturbation to that system, that is an unstable situation. Or let's say you can imagine like being a bowl in the top of a mountain.
Right.
If you got a very, how do you say, small perturbation to that system, the system collapsed. So that kind of combination, it is very unable.
That
may
just be a motivation for people trying to leave that civilization, which causes people to go out into space.
Precisely. For an example, the high technology of the Polynesians, which compared to Neolithic, Catalytic societies, that's high technology, being able to navigate vast distances over the ocean and whatnot. Typically, they end up on a small island, and the population would grow and maybe the pressures to eventually leave. In the meantime, with their high technology, with their stone axes, they have wiped out the entire ecology of the island and they're forced to move on.
There's a big difference in the scale that we are your example has a big difference in the scale
of
things.
I agree.
And seeing it not only in distance, but in energies and in technology.
I don't think that same analogy being applied to a civilization with a much more advanced technology, with the capability of traveling to other star systems. Why wouldn't they have the same type of thing where, okay, we don't care, we're going to destroy the ecology of a planet, we're going to destroy the entire solar system, we'll just move on to the next one.
Move on to structure, please.
There's a strange notion of moral progress here at work as well, because even granting the basic analysis, which is that our technology has outrun our morals, what actually is needed? I mean, once again, if you just sort of ask most people most of the time, where they get their moral guidance, it's not from the latest word in morality, but generally speaking, it's from some principles that tend to be older rather than newer. From that point of view, moral progress comes on the basis of living up to ideals which have long been articulated and imaginably, if they were actualized, would create far more stability between our technology and our moral capacity. Now, if, my God, was that really an applause line? But where then, what is going to help us in that regard? What more do we need than that older wisdom that's going to be supplied to us by an extraterrestrial intelligence?
I think there's another argument you can make along the same lines in support of correlation. I think you're being a little bit too cynical here to see no correlation whatsoever between intelligence or technological advancement.
Wait a minute. I'm merely posing the question. I'm not trying to say that I favor any particular attitude,
okay.
But I think the question itself, is important.
Anyway, I personally do see a correlation, and in addition to this natural selection process of morals and technology, I would also pose in light of self-interest, that the more advanced the civilization is, the more it has to lose at any given time. The more the individual has to lose at any given time.
Well, then, what self-interest, though, would a communicating, especially higher, a technological civilization of a higher intelligence nature, what self-interest motivation would they have, especially if they were to communicate to, let's say, a lesser, what reasons do we have other than, a sort of a scientific
right.
curiosity?
So besides your intergalactic network answer, I'd like to, if there's another answer, I'd like to hear it.
You got a hand up.
I believe that there is a universal drive to communicate, which would be a prerequisite for any society having been able to cooperate long enough to reach the level of technology that we're talking about. So they're going to a priori have the drive to communicate, and the drive to communicate is going to naturally transcend their own solar system as they want to reach out and communicate and establish friendships or cooperation with other galactic civilizations. I'm saying that the drive to communicate is a prerequisite to developing this technology.
And also, as the society internally develops these morals, it applies them to members who are not in society.
So again, it has to come down to what is the motivation within the context of society.
Yeah, what causes them to proselytize? What is it, like a religious leader or a religious sect generally, unless they're peculiar, they wish to proselytize their point of view because they feel it has a redemptive nature. It does them as well as all those recipients that they feel could benefit from it, Well, we raised the point earlier, or somebody did, that comparing notes is okay. I think if Monty and the rest of us here who have some technology background of roughly similar scale, it's good to communicate then. You're talking to each other. But there was a time when I couldn't have talked to Mr. Monty, whose books I read, gotten to the point where I can talk to him. Now I feel a little bit more confident about this exchange. But long ago, there wouldn't have been much good reason for Mr. Monty to talk to me, because I was not nearly at his level of confidence, not that I'm now either, but...
You were telling me, there was a study that said, when there is as little as a 20-point IQ spread between two individuals of the same culture, that precludes full communication. So we need to find people.
Just rest or definitely education is going to be a large part of any communication process. It won't be true communication, it will be exchange of information. Are these laws the same in your corner of the galaxy? Does gravitation apply? Does that apply? And we'll have to, it's taking a long time to get a response back, but it will be a long education process for both civilizations.
Well, you just think in terms of ever getting this world to transmit, with putting in the energy and the money and overcoming the fears involved, which to me, a bigger issue than even the economic implications is the fear factor. I mean, you're...
One of the big fears in the discussion in Oslo was, how are we going to prevent a road guy going out and getting an antenna and it beaming out a message once the signal's gotten in?
Okay,
we're not going through it. And that was basically the conclusion. If you can't prevent somebody from allocating the resources or getting the resources necessary to put negative ones and beam enough toward a given thing, whether it's in laser form or RF form, it wouldn't matter.
Right. The intergalactic internet is going to be just like the terrestrial one. Garbage out, garbage out.
Oh, what a quality of garbage.
I want to make a comment about the issue of morals. I think the confusion between morals and intelligence, what's good for a society doesn't necessarily have to be moral. I'm not saying parents, but I think a lot of discussion is assuming the individual as an important entity as opposed to the whole society. You have a society that's facing the whole that's greater than the individual, and individuals lose self-sacrifice for whatever reason. But there's a general agreement as before a society acting as an organism. You can still have something advanced and organized and sent out the state, but still eliminating anything in its path for fear of self-preservation and what's better for the whole of the race. And the issue of morals necessarily an issue, not moral in the sense of how it became.
Well, see, what your argument is exactly the reason that the fear factor will dominate the argument of transmission, because you just argued that you can have a situation where the morals aren't going to dominate the situation, even though they might be intelligent, powerful beings. And even though that might be wrong, and we might think it's wrong because there's a certain set of morals we'd all like to see the society have, that argument that you just gave is the very reason why it's going to be very difficult to get anybody to ever agree to transmit.
Well, hold on, Monty. What's the difference between transmitting a direct purposeful message, okay? And for these extraterrestrials who have received Earth leakage from our TV transmitters and what have you, and know we're here.
Well, no, you don't know that.
No, but if they have been eavesdropping and they know we're here, what little difference is there?
Revealing our position in...
Revealing our position.
There is a big difference.
Input on that idea.
Yeah,
I think that if you have an active communication vis-a-vis an accidental, pickup, so to speak, there is a difference, because if you're truly communicating, then you're most likely transacting something. You're exchanging something for somebody's benefit, and the manner in which that benefit is assessed can be very self-serving. Okay, it may be neutral. It may be a win-win game. It may be any number of things.
It's a poker game. Yeah. In a sense, you don't reveal if you're good at poker. You just don't reveal information, because you don't know what information, how that's going to be used against you.
But look,
is it better to keep your silent, to be thought a fool, than to open your mouth?
But we've been doing that for 40 or 50 years.
I'm saying that's there's a difference between sending out BMUs beams and I Love Lucy shows, okay, and actually transacting, you know, a communications link where two parties are by contract, so to speak, you know, exchanging something which could be utilized against you, as you know, Tommy says. Yeah. And society does have, I think, a justifiable reason. Even if nobody really logics this out, but merely a consensus, an attitude is developed. Right. Hey guys, we better go easy.
Remember the big furor 22 years ago about the Arecibo message, the 2380
megahertz
beam. Barney Oliver was one of the strongest critics of the concept of transmitting at that particular time, which really surprised me. And in fact, maintained a sort of a pseudo-paranoid streak all throughout his life. The last communication I had with Barney, 2 weeks before he died, he actually proposed that maybe since we've been listening for 35 years and not received anything substantive yet, maybe it's time to start transmitting and set out an intergalactic wake-up call. Right. Now, if Barney can be turned around on this, anyone can.
Well, let me give you another example in the same line. When the first pulsar was discovered, the head of the research group was Martin Wright. Well, Tony Hewish described the discovery, and well, Martin Wright said, "Well, if these are real ET signals, we should never announce this discovery because somebody in planet Earth will try to respond, and that will reveal our position in the galaxy. And this bad extraterrestrial which came here and eat us." The second, well, then when it appears that these signals appear in four different places in the sky, the chance that these signals could be originated by intelligent civilization were very low. So the second part of the story was in 1974, when Frank Drake sent this message to M13, where Martin Rive tried to pass a special resolution, was very angry because of that, tried to pass a special resolution into the International Astronomical Union to prohibit any further transmission. Again, because this will be dangerous for us to reveal our position in the sky. But it is very, very, very strange that a person with the experience of Martin Wright, a Nobel Prize winner, the Astronomer Royal from England, didn't realize that we were transmitting signals.
Of course,
he was not conscious about that. Frank Drake has to send him a letter explaining that we are continually transmitting signals into Earth. And let me give you an example. For example, there is early warning radar that belongs to the Marine that illuminates almost 33% of the whole sky at least 7 seconds per day. So that signal has the necessary strength to be detected by an Arecibo dish at 60 light years from Earth, and with a Cyclops system, some sort of 600 light years from Earth. So at this distance, you will have something like 1 million stars. So these early warning radar signals are leaving the Earth and could be detected by a Cyclops technology civilization in the next 600 years.
Yeah, providing, of course, that within even 600 years, there is a receptive ear, which I have some difficulty, you know, after massaging a bunch of these, you know, probabilities in the Drake equation and looking into them and seeing what the probabilities are. You develop, you know, a certain feel for it, and it's all just intuition, really. I mean, everybody has their own version of it, right? But mine is that I have the feeling, maybe I'm too pessimistic about this, but we're going to be looking out farther than 600 years. I get the impression that it's a kind of a several thousand year kind of a thing. you know, maybe 3,000, maybe 10,000 or so. So even if we do have leakage, it may not have receptive ears. And of course, I can be totally wrong about this, and God, there might be a retinue of plants around Pegasus 51, you know, and lo and behold, in 50 years. Yeah, right.
Actually, this is thought about sending out signals and, oh my God, they're going to find out where we are, they're going to come and eat us. It's all rather silly, because if you have a society that's able to travel amongst the stars, at some point or another, I mean, they're just going to be passing by, they're going to hear, just, you know, I love Lucy, or even if they're not even listening for that, I mean, eventually, maybe they're just going to stop by just to see what's going on in this particular area of the galaxy, or maybe they're going to make a pit stop and go to the bathroom, and they're going to find us anyway. Eventually, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, if you look at the entire history of the Earth, I mean, you know, over millions, billions of years.
You certainly, in the long run, what you say is true, but fear is generally irrational.
But what's really in dispute here, it seems to me, is what constitutes a rational response.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I can risk being the fool by saying something that I know you all know, but maybe drawing out the consequences a little further, we haven't the vaguest notion, right? We haven't a clue. It could be the Ferengi out there listening for our message, and they'll hear it and say, boy, this is right pickings. And it could be the Borg, and it could be the Vulcans. You know, we could get lucky. We just don't have a clue. And the question is what the consequence of that is for SETI as a scientific enterprise. And it really has a problematic, it has a great consequence, which is to say it is part of what allows and promotes a highly interdisciplinary, highly, highly free atmosphere of speculation. Okay? But it has a more problematic side as well, which is that it promotes a highly disciplinary, highly free kind of speculation. But scientific progress in other realms occurs because basic assumptions, at least, are agreed upon. There's a confined universe of discourse that people, by and large, adhere to. And at certain points, they might find that that confined universe is inadequate. It may have to be abandoned. It may have to be changed. But there are some things held in common. And to the extent that SETI lacks that, it's going to be problematic in terms of the progress it can make, short of playing the odds. And you know, by God, someday somebody's going to get the signal, and at least we'll go on that.
Well, following your line of argument, every society that's advanced in some way or intelligent can adopt the same viewpoint, and even though they're capable of transmitting, out of fear, will not. So there can be equivalent societies to ours around that could have the capability of transmitting, but they won't do it out of the same fear factor.
The other thing is, I think marshalling resources requires any society on every civilization to have an economics. It means you're going to have to take some resources from here and put it into that beacon that they have. And the question is, what is the motivation within a context of
that's right.
A couple weeks ago, I asked by email John Billingham whether or not I could reproduce as an appendix to the proceedings the post-detection, basically replying protocol, corollary to the what I did with basically the detection protocol that was in the appendix in the first proceeding. I spoke to John last night, and he said that they about to put it on the web, and he will get me a copy, and it'll be okay to put it into proceedings. So we can get to read what's been now recently officially decided as to what the procedure is.
No, it's a position paper.
Well, hold on,
it's not a
well. It's been going around for a couple of years now.
Yes, and but it is wrote as a position proposal. The idea is to take this position paper to different governments,
United Nations.
Just to different individual governments, and each of these individual governments should take it simultaneously to the UN sort of agreement. But I'm skeptical about the results of this kind of agreement. You can see what happened with the Moon Treaty or the Space Treaty. So
we're going to go to war. I mean, we'll say, for example, the majority of the countries in the, on this planet decide it's not a good idea to be transmitting and sending a reply.
But one country did.
But one country said, damn, we're going to do it. What are we going to do? We're going to go to war with them? We're going to nuke them out of existence?
Surgical strike.
Sounds good to me, Chris.
Well, actually, Bob Dixon tried to see if there is any regulation in the U.S. to send transmission to other systems, and he didn't find anything. No. So it is legal.
You mean FCC Part 15 rules do not apply?
But can you get advertisers? That's the real question.
Well, that was pretty worrying. How are you going to stop that guy
who
just wants to go do it?
Yeah.
That's right.
For whatever his personal motivations are.
Yeah, it's a motivated millionaire. Yeah. Builds himself a system.
Yeah. But the cause is
if they're out there on the malevolent, they probably would destroy us already.
So then, Eurico Fermi's question becomes, where are we?
Why haven't we been eaten yet?
And the other thing is, regarding the issue of possible self-interest or why they want to contact us, they don't know that we're not more advanced than they are. We think we're the least advanced than they are.
False humility.
The correlation generally is made that if you're transmitting, then you're superior to those that are only receiving. Now, whether or not that's fallacious or not.
You're superior to SWLs, that's right.
Yeah. Whether that's fallacious or not, there's some
humanness there. Way of looking.
Yes. I'm, you know, getting back to transmit or not, I have ambivalent notions about it. I am definitely a proponent of it, as you heard me say. But this only stems from a technical point of view. Namely, I think the whole SETI issue is an extremely good case of how to experiment scientifically. Namely, you know, there's probably three reasons for why you want to experiment. One is, if you for certain know something, you have these grand intuitions such and so, but the rest of society doesn't either know or disagrees, you go ahead and perform your experiment, by God, you're going to nail it down. That's one world. The other one is that, you know, there is a generalized ambiguity about things, and you work at it hard enough, and you resolve something. Then, besides those two, there's the converse completely, and that is, nothing is known, okay? No matter which way you turn, okay, nothing is known. Hey, isn't that the most wonderful way of why you want to go ahead and find it? Get to an experiment? Okay, well, I'd like to see a situation where the whole business of maximally enhancing what we can do to solve the SETI problem occurs, and that is to become not only passively receptive, you know, I hope you have lots of success, but I think to promote this proactively by, in fact, causing the initial step to make that link go. I think that the society out there, should there be any, if they receive even the most rudimentary forms, but I think of directed energy at them, will stop and think, hey, even if these guys are technically inferior or whatever, it's worthwhile to talk to them because they have crossed the threshold they are in. I'm sure all these things have been thought of before. And,
I have a possible answer to the Fermi question that is the following. Well, they know really that we are here. But knowing our history, they know that we only evolve when we face a common enemy. A common enemy. Then, knowing how we are, this is a role that, again, that they don't want to play. Mm-hmm. To come here and compete in an enemy of us. they don't want to talk with us.
If you lost them, they move down.
In other words, we're the brain.
It's another version of the Sulk hypothesis.
Yeah, cognitive.
Yeah. Okay.
To, to paraphrase a well-known Hungarian, they are here, but they call themselves Spaniards.
Can we talk about some technical questions? And in fact, I have one for Paul. I mean, I shouldn't really look a gift horse in the mouth. You did your analysis between the different types of setting. I was looking through your paper last night, double-checking. You made a mention about you sort of normalized to power bandwidth product or something like that. But I noticed on the different systems you had picked different powers.
Oh, okay.
And also different bandwidths. Mm-hmm. And when I had done my analysis, I kept the same power, same bandwidth.
Valid question.
And so I think I may have been shortchanged by a factor of 10 or so on the optical.
Okay, I'll reply to that.
Yeah.
Very good question. Yes, I was constrained as follows. When doing my analysis in Arecibo, for interest of consistency with trying to verify Frank's calculations, I use his Arecibo power measurements. I did not use his bandwidth measurement because I personally take issue with that as an initial assumption. This is almost like a chaotic system in that the results you achieve are highly dependent upon initial conditions. And my personal case I was trying to make in the paper with regard to Arecibo, and I'll get to the optical in a moment, is that there may be a technological capacity for developing 10 millihertz bandwidth, but there are some good reasons not to. And I picked 1 hertz bandwidth being taken this with the Cyclops report. It turns out that the 600 millihertz that Jill Trotter was talking about is consistent with that within round off error. So the power I picked was Cyclops's power, was Arecibo's power, but I merely diddled the bandwidth. In the case of the Cyclops analysis, I used the same bandwidth that Barney Oliver had used in the Cyclops report. I changed only the power. And the reason I changed the power there, as I hoped I had explained in the text, which you'll all see in the proceedings, is because Barney did his analysis at X-band, I did my analysis at L-band, so I was able to up the power a little bit, just based upon the state of technology.
You also used different integration times.
On Barney's, I used the exact same integration time. On Cyclops, I used the same integration time that Barney had. And in the analysis of Arecibo, I was going to the absolute maximum integration time that Arecibo would permit, which was actually 2 hours and 20 minutes, roughly. 8,000 seconds. I went to that number because Chip Cohen said, but you're not giving them the benefit of the doubt. And I figured, okay, give them the benefit of the doubt. I still couldn't come anywhere near to Frank's number. So I was trying to bend over backwards and say, okay, let's do the best we can do. It still isn't going to make it across the galaxy. It might make it almost to the galactic center. Actually, I ended up with 10,000 light years with my analysis, which was far short of this image of 10 times greater distances. Now, when I came to optical, I used the 1 kilowatt
normalization thing with 1 hertz, with no integration.
Right. Just to see what the simplest system could do, because I was pleased to see that the simplest system for the optical assumption was consistent with the simplest microwave system, that being the Project Argus. They had about the same range. Now, you could do better, no question about that.
Well, I mean, at least you could put 100 kilowatts or more into the
yes,
optical.
Very likely. Just like we could do better than what we're doing at Cyclops.
Well, so Cyclops, you could, because it's such a huge array, you could put,
a transmitter on each of the
You could have maybe 100 megawatts or something
right.
Going out of that system.
Mm-hmm. The purpose of, I think, of Barney's initial analysis of the Cyclops report was to indicate you didn't have to be very analogous in the transmitter or the receiver if you had the capture area. Now, it's true that capture area occurs two different ways. You can have capture area by having very large antennas or very short wavelengths. Yeah. You're getting capture area. Yeah. Now, I did try to really compare the optical capabilities of a simple system to the very, very best microwave, rather to a simple microwave system. Let's look at an Argus amateur microwave radio telescope. Let's look at what an advanced amateur could conceivably do optically. They correlate quite well. Therefore, the extrapolation is, if an amateur effort for optics is consistent with an amateur effort for microwave, then perhaps a full-blown, high-resources effort for optics would be consistent with a Arecibo or maybe even a Cyclops. But the real problem is this. in all these cases, we're assuming a high-end technology at the other end of the link. How many confirmed Cyclopses do we have in the Milky Way galaxy? For that matter, how many Arecibos? You can count them on the thumbs of one hand. As I think I said in the paper.
Any other?
Can I ask a semi-technical question? I know there's what's known as like piggyback SETI in the radio.
Parasitic SETI, yes.
Oh, is that really? Oh, okay.
We call it parasitic SETI, okay. Yes.
Is anything like that possible for optical, for you optical people?
Sure, very easily.
Yeah,
possible.
I mean,
in fact, I have proposed, soon after I got into looking at SETI, I had proposed really a sort of serendipity type of program where actually, with the great telescopes of the world, optical SETI could be done if you didn't mind having the dome open and the business about the temperature of the dome, etc. at night. And of course, then you could use adaptive optics perhaps to correct the turbulence effects and that new technology could come along to solve the new problem. Use the big telescopes during the day for optical SETI and use it for conventional astronomy at night. Besides actually using it the same real time like you do with Serendip and collect data for different instrumentation.
Yeah, but my other point.
Yes, it could be done, sure. I think it probably will be done one day, once the people get into optical
SETI. It could be some sort of problems of instrumentation.
Right. Well, given that you had a port on the Keck available to you.
Yeah.
Given that someone gave you an optical port on the Keck, what would it take in instrumentation to piggyback the SETI?
We're talking about doing want to distract from the normal, activity.
Let's put a 10-to-1 pellicle on there, so you're getting a 10 dB down signal.
If you want to do that, because if you can afford to do it with a big telescope, you can afford to take a little bit off, and it would hardly be
drop
noticed.
I'll drop a quarter of a dB, so what?
Yeah, or we could do it in terms of a filter, which, it doesn't affect the normal astronomical observations, and we have to use that filter just to be looking at that wavelength for optical setting. So, sure, that could be done.
Can
you back on
that? Yeah, it is. Like Sue says, you can design it so you're just looking at one little narrow part of the spectrum at a time, so that you're really not taking much of the total light off.
So you need to impact the normal observation of doing optical SETI at the same time.
Well, considering that microwave SETIsms are doing parasitic radio astronomy.
We could do parasitic optical
SETI. Yeah. No, you could do parasitic optical astronomy with your SETI observatory.
Parasitic optical astronomy. But of course the astronomers don't like that.
No, but let's put it in a proper place.
But hold on, it's their telescopes that we have to borrow, so we should be very nice with it.
Oh, like the famous cartoon, just checking. Actually, I see optical telescopes being highly compatible with radio telescopes. They should be co-located.
They're all digital these days anyway, right?
Right. It doesn't matter whether your ones and zeros came from short photons or long photons. I mean,
well, it's what Vali used to refer as, he preferred warm, fuzzy photons.
Yes.
It seems a problem with it.
Right.
Well, it depends.
During the daytime, for example.
You're sharing the hours. But even if you share it. Well, actually, I think they may have more problems with the temperature situation.
More than you, about my experience, trying to ask for the Mania, for example. In Argentina, we have the Mania detector, which has a 10 to the minus 7 second. The resolution. So we submit twice a proposal to explore something like 30 nearby stars, that means 3 nights, something like that. And in both occasions they reject the proposal because they consider that our arguments were totally absurd, that we will be unable to detect any kind of things. And well, probably the main argument is that each second we have 10 to the 7 different numbers for each second. So if you observe let's say 3 minutes that star, you have something like 10 to the 9 or something like that, different data. How do you find in so huge amount of data any pulses or something like that? How do you process that information? Yeah. And certainly it is a limitation in the hardware and in the software. Well,
it's a temporary technological limitation, it needs to be solved. On that subject, of course, there's also a question of recommission and decommission telescopes, or decommission because of light pollution.
Yes.
Cut through the light pollution, not be worried by it.
Stuart, this isn't a crazy idea. I'm kind of thinking off the top of my head here, thinking aloud, so it may be totally invalid. You're proposing the use of heterodyne conversion optical receivers.
That was the first system. That's not what I'm doing.
That has been proposed.
Or the monochromatic beacon.
And that has some tremendous sensitivity advantages because you control the IF bandwidth.
Yeah, that's why you can get down to the hertz level and you can shot noise limited and all
what
that.
What kind of IFs have been contemplated? What kind of intermediate frequencies?
You could do it by going down twice, so like super head. So you can go down. You can go down to the 1 hertz level. And
that's the detector. But I'm talking about the intermediate frequencies.
The IF is usually one gigahertz.
You can go
straight to the RF system.
Now you've already got the digital signal processing hardware in the RF software.
Well, I imagine that. I mean, you basically
the real purpose of the RF people is to develop their technology until we can take over.
There's a reason why I'm asking this. This is another opportunity for parasitic SETI. And that is, you come up with a telescope and an optical to L-band converter, and all we need is to be able to switch
between the sources then.
And then the rest of the system already exists for you, including all the DSP hardware and software.
As we said, that's what their purpose was, okay?
This brings to mind a early in my career as an electrical engineer, as a microwave circuit designer, I had just finished a job where I was producing low noise amplifiers and bandpass filters and mixers for the 1.3 gigahertz region. And I went to a job interview at an aerospace company that was hiring a microwave engineer. And I thought this was really hot stuff, high frequency, really advanced, talking 20 some odd years ago. So I brought some samples of my work in to the job interview. They looked at my 1.3 gigahertz receiving hardware, which was quite impressive at the time, and they decided to hire me and give me a job in their intermediate frequency lab. This was appropriate for them for IF. I thought this was microwave. So I got a job actually for this aerospace company in their IF lab. I may very well be in your IF lab for all.
Well, it's very true. If you want to pick a number of common single mode lasers that are visible, if people get hold of that. One of the things you have to, of course, watch is that the coherence cell size is about 20 centimeters. So unless you're going to employ your own adaptive optics, there's not much point in going over that aperture if you want to use heterodyne detection.
Well, you got to know the frequency of the laser.
It is feasible to do your first mix down to 1420.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's the easy part.
You know.
The hard part is the other stuff.
Once at 1420, it becomes
true. I started my fiber optics career doing heterodyne detection in the visible with fibers, with single mode fibers. Yeah. I did a coherent data highway in those days, not a super highway or information highway, we called it a data highway. So, I'm quite familiar with doing that, and so it is doable.
But you have to know the frequency.
The
advantage of what we were talking about, I think that you have to recognize that what we were talking about earlier, the systems we were talking about, you don't need to know the laser frequency. You're doing direct detection. Sure. When you talk about heterodyne,
in the RF universe, direct detection is hampered by microphonics and noise.
Right,
and
but it's not true.
It's not true optically.
Yeah, that's one of the big differences. Are there any, chapter 5, any other thing we ought to wrap this up, I guess?
She wears WWV on her wrist. Don't argue with her.
I tuned up this clock on 12 hertz, receiver last week. Tuesday last week.
I have to say that for my biological clock is 10 p.m. It is 2 a.m.
Thank everybody for contributing to this discussion. Very interesting, and I enjoyed it anyway.
Okay, should the chairman have a closing remark? I should have a closing remark. Yes. I'd like to thank everyone who participated. I enjoyed it. Thank the board for his splendid entertainment. And to everyone who participated in the conference. And for my co-chair, hope the next time we meet, you're a lot healthier.
And we'll see you all in Capri in July.
All right.
Maybe.